few words of introduction. I'll use, first of all, what's on the website. Before coming to work for MFC, Sherry worked for an agricultural co-op for 13 years, most recently as their store manager. Which store or Sherry?
In Elmira.
Elmira, okay. Sherry has received registered retirement consultant designation, nationally recognized standard preferred by the Canadian Institute of Financial Planning. She's also completed the Georgian College Plan Giving course, as well as an Ontario Wills and Estates course. Sherry graduated from the University of Waterloo with a BA in Sociology. Sherry is a member of the Canadian Association of Gift Planners, and she and her husband, Rob, attend Elmira Mennonite Church. And I want to just add a plug for you, and I invite you to tell the congregation what other services you do, but I want to put in a plug for the Wills and Estates part of it. If you get a counseling session from Mennonite Foundation of Canada, they will reimburse you up to $200 for bill expenses at a lawyer's. So basically, like if the lawyer costs $400, you cover $200 of that. So it's a very valuable service, and if you don't have a will, you should have one, and they would be glad to help you with that and help financially as well towards the cost. So please welcome with me, Sherry Rose.
Thank you. I am so happy to be here. I am from the Kitchener Office of Mennonite Foundation, and we are the stewardship arm of six different denominations across Canada. We're a national organization, including the Evangelical Missionary Church of Canada and Mennonite Church of Canada, are the two that are mostly Ontario. And we basically do three things as a foundation. We are a charity, and so we work with churches, and we preach and teach on stewardship around things of generosity and contentment and giving and those sorts of things, much like we do today. We work with individuals who want to be generous, and as part of that, we provide the will and estate planning services that Ernest had mentioned, where we will meet with you ahead of time. We will help you think through what needs to be included in your will as part of your particular circumstance. And in appreciation for you taking that time, it's usually about an hour, as well as recognition that wills are expensive and necessary, and so it's a little bit of a carrot to entice you, we will cover half of the cost to a maximum of $200. And all you need to do is actually finish up your wills and send us a copy of the invoice from the lawyer. So we don't actually need to see the will, just a copy of the invoice, and we'll send that check back to say, good, you know, someone else has actually done this important step. The third thing we do, which is what basically pays for most of the first two, is that we manage charitable funds. So we have about $120 million of charitable assets, national assets, that we're managing on behalf of churches and other charities. So these are scholarship funds, endowment funds, building funds, temporary funds that churches have, maybe some surplus, those kinds of things, as well as funds from individuals that they're intending to send out to charity, either in the short term or in the longer term. So that is what allows me to be on salary and not on commission. So we really have nothing to sell. We are able to do this as a ministry, to work with churches and with individuals and say, how is it that we can help you be generous? Is there some knowledge that we have about ways you can give that maybe you're not aware that you're interested in? Is there something we can inspire you in, some way that we can work together to help the Ministry of Living Water and the ministries that you find important and that you want to bless? How can we help all of those things forward? That's a little bit about what we do. I found an interesting quote in the paper this last week, and a woman said, why spend money when you already have everything you need? And I thought, now there's a question that's asked by somebody who has found contentment. They've determined that they have enough and that they really don't need anything more. They don't want for anything. But it's an unusual one, because for most of us, it's hard to say what is enough. How do we know we have enough? Now, I don't need a calendar to know that Christmas is coming, because I get enough flyers in my newspaper. I've noticed that they've very kindly waited until after Halloween, Thanksgiving, and Remembrance Day, but my newspaper in Kitchener has doubled in weight and thickness at the end of this week. And I counted the flyers one day, just out of curiosity, and I had 20 separate flyers one day. And they varied. Some were quite thick and stapled, looked more like a catalog. Others were very they just folded together. Some were glossy, some weren't. Some came with coupons or promises of points if I shopped there. Others showed off new, exclusive, or those limited time items. If I don't get them now, they'll probably be gone. Some promised deep discounts and fantastic sale prices. And they're all designed to lure me into having a look and finding something else that I need to help me celebrate Christmas properly. And thank goodness for the blue box. Because I alternate between knowing that I have enough, and oftentimes too much, and being willingly enticed into buying something else that I don't really need but would really like to have. Perhaps you also came across the story of Alan and Violet Large of Nova Scotia. They won $11 million in the lottery, and the couple quickly determined that they didn't actually need it, and so they worked very hard at giving nearly all of it away. They still had their same 13-year-old car and the same 5-year-old truck as before they won. They say they kept about 2%, a couple $100,000 out of the $11 million, and gave the rest away, some to family, but most to charities. And Violet, who is recovering from cancer, has just finished chemo, I believe, is quoted as saying, "Why spend money when you already have everything you need? Why indeed? Why would you want more when you have everything?" But the cultural messages, as we see from these advertising, teach us that we better hold on tightly to what we have, and indeed we need more. We'd better keep it all for ourselves, just in case. You never know how much you might need or when you might need it, and it doesn't matter if we fall into the category of rich or poor, we still have the sense that we don't quite have enough. Millionaires and billionaires who've been interviewed say that just a little more would be enough. They would feel secure, just a little. And a similar response might come from us. Just a little more than what I have now would be enough. I would feel more secure. So it's kind of a broad thing, that regardless of how much we have, just a little more, just a little bit, that's all we would need. And it's odd that we live with this sense of not quite having enough, because North Americans live at the top with the world's richest people. It's a wonderful website you can go to called globalrichlist.com. You enter your annual income in Canadian dollars, and it will show you where you rank in the world. You might be surprised. A full-time minimum wage job here in Ontario will put you into the top 12% of the world. If you have $53,000 Canadian in income, you're in the top 1%. Congratulations. The top 1% of the world's richest people. You, me, and the bajillionaires rubbing shoulders. It's pretty uncomfortable, really. It's very easy to look up that ladder of success and see those that are richer, that have more, that can do more. I live in Kitchener. We have Research in Motion, aka the BlackBerry, well-known tech company. According to Forbes, the co-owners, Mike Lazaridis and Jim Balsley, each earned over $1 million in salary in 2010. And according to Forbes, they're both billionaires and very generous folks. I can easily be envious of their income. What that would let me do, the things that I could accomplish with that kind of money. But I'm not going to be living their life, and I'm never going to have an income that they do. A few blocks away in the other direction is a local agency in Kitchener called House of Friendship. And amongst many other services, they provide shelter for homeless men. And I don't very often reflect on how my life differs from those gentlemen. I have a home. I have a job. I have physical, emotional, and mental health, and I'm surrounded by caring family and friends. It's very easy to look up that ladder. I can also go beyond home and look at those in the broader world, those who are struggling to survive, who go to sleep hungry or sick, who don't have a safe or secure home, who can't trust their police and military to protect them. It's pretty easy to look up, but it's pretty difficult, and not very often that we actually turn around and look at all of those behind us. We, here, have a lot. If we look at 2 Corinthians, it says, God can pour on blessings in astonishing ways so that you're ready for anything and everything, more than just ready to do what needs to be done. As one psalmist puts it, he throws caution to the winds, giving to the needy in reckless abandon. His right living, right giving ways never run out and never wear out. As we know, Christmas is approaching. And it's a time when Christians the world over are again reminded that God came to earth to live as we do, to live with the bumps, the bruises, the joy, and the pain. And that's an extravagance that God sent his Son, and it's an extravagance that's really difficult to kind of comprehend. We have a God of exceeding compassion, love, and generosity. God gives us his best and does it with joy. This most generous God, who gives seed to the farmer that becomes bread for your meals, is more than extravagant with you. You are given something that you can then give away, which grows into full-formed lives, robust in God, wealthy in every way, so that you can be generous in every way, producing with us great praise to God. God blesses us so that we can give it away. God challenges us to give and promises to bless us, and in fact will bless us first so that we can give abundantly. God will prosper us so that we can be generous, with extravagance, and with reckless abandon. God does not want us to be a storage unit to collect and to keep, or simply to use it all for ourselves. God wants us to be like a pitcher that will collect that which is given to us and then pour it out on those around us. But we need to allow God to use us. We need to trust that God will provide for our needs and perhaps not all of our wants. But if we truly believe that God will look after us, we can be less attached to the things in this world. But it's a hard thing to do. I want to share another story, a story of Hannah Salwin, with you. Hannah has long had a tender heart for those in need. She had been taught from a young age to care about those around her. Her parents had modeled volunteerism and generosity, and as Hannah and her brother grew older, the family regularly volunteered in soup kitchens, at food banks, and Habitat for Humanity builds. But as she grew into her teens, Hannah was becoming keenly aware of how much some had and how little others had. The injustice bothered her, and she would occasionally discuss it with her family. One day, while at a stoplight near their home in a city, 15-year-old Hannah noticed a homeless man with a sign asking for food, juxtaposed against a brand new, glistening Mercedes coupe. "You know, Dad," she said, "if that man had a less nice car, that man could have a meal." Dad replied, "Hannah, if we had a less nice car, that man could also have a meal." They mulled and discussed for the rest of the drive home, as they had many times over the years and with many topics. But this time it was different, and something had gotten under Hannah's skin. Supper and the entire rest of the evening were spent with Hannah continuing to push and challenge her parents and her brother. She wanted to be part of a family that actually did something to affect change in the world, not just talk and lament about how the world was unfair. The parents, of course, felt they were doing something. They were doing lots. What were all those nights and weekends at the food bank, the soup kitchen, and the Habitat builds? How about all the hundreds of hours the parents had spent volunteering on charity boards, at dinners, at banquets, and at events? What about all the generous checks that had been written? They were a family that was doing a lot. And his parents decided they were going to read their daughter out of her idealism and back into reality. So they calmly and rationally explained all the things that the family was doing. How they were generous with their time and money, how they encouraged their peers to also be generous with time and money, how they had raised Hannah and her brother to be aware of the need around them, how the family regularly volunteered. Noah. Hannah was having none of it. So finally, totally exasperated, they said, "What do you want to do, Hannah? Sell our house?" "Yes," she said, relieved that her parents finally understood. "Yes, let's sell our house and give the money away." Like Hannah, Paul is also aware of the economic disparity while writing to the churches. The Christians in Judea were suffering and needed money to pay for basic needs, things like food, clothing, and shelter. And Paul wrote this letter to remind them that he'd already bragged about their generosity. He knows that they have a tender heart, and they will want to help fellow believers. He begins to give clear, step-by-step instructions of the process they should take. They should carefully consider what they might give. The toss some coins into the collection and not think about what they might need. They need to make their decision privately, not publicly, and not be affected by the size of the gifts that others make. It's not a competition. And it wasn't supposed to make some people feel compelled to give more than they could afford, or to make others proud and boastful that they could be so generous. But Paul does encourage them to be generous and reminds them that God loves a cheerful giver. Paul knew the churches in Corinth weren't rich by any means, but they did have enough to cover their own needs, and they certainly had more than these other Christians. He also knew that by creating a culture of generosity and trust, the churches could give without fear, knowing that they could also rely on fellow Christians to give should they have a need. They could take a risk and give cheerfully and joyfully. When the Christians in Judea received the collection, they'd be overjoyed with the generosity and they would overflow with praise and thanksgiving to God for meeting their needs and for the generosity of the Corinthians. We haven't really changed that much, and the rules and recommendations from the Corinthian passage still fits us today. We're the ones that have enough and more than many of our fellow Christians and others around the globe. Some of us have learned to be content. Some of us have learned to be generous, and some of us still struggle with money and its proper place. And perhaps you identify with all three of those. Perhaps you are content and generous, and yet still end up wrestling with money sometimes. Money and its use takes up a lot of space in our lives. We spend our time working to earn it, trying to save it, figuring out how to invest it, paying it back, or trying to find the best way to give some away. This morning could be an example. I had breakfast this morning, money for groceries, money for the fridge and the electricity to keep it on, money for table and chairs, money for kitchen cupboards and sink, dishes, utensils, money. I got here this morning in a car, money for gas, insurance, repairs and maintenance, and of course don't forget money to buy the car. Look around, we have lights, money, we have heat, money, we have instruments, equipment, space, money. Virtually everything that we see, do, or touch costs money in some way. And it's easy for money to be our main focus, but that really isn't the thing that we should love or focus on. Many books report that the best and only way to keep money in its place is to regularly and carefully make sure that you give some away. Focusing on regular giving has been the way to reduce the stress around money, to acknowledge that we do have enough, and that we even have some extra to share. We're not designed to be storage units. We're designed to be generous. We're designed to be the hands and feet of Jesus in this world, to care for those around us, to share, and to pray, and to love. So how are we going to do that? Well, first off, carefully consider what you have. What is it that you have? Consider what you need, and consider the needs of those that depend on you. Be realistic. Pray for wisdom and guidance as you work to determine how much is enough. We'll be talking later today about how to review your personal finances and some guidelines and suggestions you can use. Second, don't worry about what others do or don't give or how they live. This decision is yours to make and yours to live with. It's not a competition. Each of us has different means, differing incomes and needs, different family situations. And lastly, some may want to consider putting a ceiling on their lifestyle, this much and no more for me and my household. Rather than having your lifestyle increase automatically as your means or your income go up, consider living intentionally below your means. This isn't a one-time task, but rather something that you'll need to be reviewed and considered on an annual basis, perhaps more often if circumstances have changed. We are the wealthy. Consider stretching and working those giving muscles on a regular basis by prayerfully and sacrificially giving your first fruits. Keep in mind that this isn't a sprint. This is a marathon in some ways. It will take time and practice to develop those muscles and to become comfortable with putting them to use. To go back to the story of Hannah and her family, they provide one example of how one specific family focused intentionally on changing their lives. Like so many other North Americans, the Salmon family got caught up in the ongoing saga of bigger, better, newer, and shinier. They hadn't stopped to question the cultural messages of bigger homes, newer cars, and more stuff. They hadn't stopped to consider how they felt about the consumption messages that they and their children were absorbing and living on a daily basis. The Salads decided to follow Hannah's urge to stop talking and start doing more, more than they had ever imagined, and so they embarked on an incredible journey together, decided to sell their much-loved home, downsize to one half its size, and give half of the profits to a worthy charity. This decision has a ripple effect, of course. Downsizing means that you have physically less space. There's simply room for fewer things. And in some cases, much-loved family items simply didn't fit. The family worked through what they would keep, what they would sell, and what they would give away. And it wasn't until they began to clear out their stuff that they realized exactly how much stuff they had. If you've ever moved, you maybe understand. Things that had been stored and forgotten, clothes that had long since been outgrown, things lost in the back of closets or under beds. They even discovered some duplicate items, presumably purchased because they couldn't find the original or perhaps didn't even remember they still had one. Every week they met over dinner to discuss their plan, and at first it was outlandish. And not everyone was immediately on board with this decision. Who wants less? Who jumps for joy over giving things up and moving to a smaller space? But then it was a challenge. We are totally doing this as a family. The journey took the family over a year from the time they decided to sell until they actually did. They were caught in the market downturn of 2008, and they had to make some really tough decisions about if and how to fund their commitment to the charity they'd chosen while their house languished on the market with no buyers in sight. There were also some very interesting and critical responses. Family and friends, of course, thought they'd lost their minds. Who does this? Who sells a house and uses half the money away? Weren't they worried about the kids being cramped or having to do without in the new space? Wasn't the whole point of being successful so that you could provide opportunities for your children that you or your parents didn't have? Some felt that it was actually a personal affront and a critique of their lives. Who are the Salads to be so sanctimonious and self-righteous? Some of these close relationships fell apart, and others took a while to heal. But some were drawn into their story. The couple that finally purchased their home was intrigued and decided to contribute. A friend of Hannah's decided to contribute half of her babysitting money to a charity she cared about. And this family is very clear that selling your house is a nutty idea and the wrong decision for everyone, except them. They don't want you to sell your house. They sold their $1.6 million mansion, which allowed them to move into a smaller space where they could spend more time together and allowed them to give over $800,000 to charity. But I don't want you to dismiss this as simply some story of a nutty, rich family being outrageous and trying to attract attention and notoriety. This was their much-loved family home. It was the home their children had been raised in, the home that they clearly remembered. There had been celebrations, sorrows, and memories made and cherished within these walls. And this was a difficult decision. Many times the parents asked, is this really the right thing? Are we really crazy? They were also keenly aware that this was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for them. Giving away $800,000 was a huge, huge responsibility and one that they were determined to get right. They researched many charities and eventually decided to work with one that whose focus was working with those in need, being given support and opportunities to improve their life, teaching them to fish, if you will. And it's a wonderful and inspiring story, and you can find it detailed in their book, if you like, The Power of Half. But their goal is ultimately to ensure that each of us take a moment to step off the treadmill of accumulation, that we each begin to define ourselves by what we give, as well as by what we have. And the Salads encourage everyone to carefully consider what it is that we have to give. What is our half? Could we give up one evening a week of TV or internet time to volunteer? Could we make space at our table and show hospitality to those that are lonely or in need? Could we give up something or some item so that we would have money to share? What could you do? What could your family do? What about this church family? What impact could you have in your community and the world? What change would be made? So what if we all work hard at actually developing good, strong generosity muscles? And what if we acknowledge that we do have enough and some to share? Are we able to say we are the rich and believe it and mean it? What if we did consider placing a ceiling on life? God invites us to join in on this fun of generosity that he expresses throughout the Bible, to learn what it feels like to be generous the way that God has been generous, to bless others the way we've been blessed, to be open to opportunities, to be available to be poured out. And that's exciting stuff. We can glimpse just for a moment the joy that God feels in extravagant generosity and giving. And I want to encourage you to talk about where you are on the road to generosity. What are your stories? How did you get here? Where have you given and why? What's inspired you? What tugs your heart and gets you all excited? And by sharing these stories, we can continue to encourage each other